We've been reading from chapter 11, which immediately follows the Damodar Lila. 9 and 10 are the Damodar Lila. So Krishna's age is very young. The towards the end of this chapter, the residents of Gokul decide to move. They decide to move to Vrindavan. They go on the other side of the river Jamuna. There were three different places that Krishna lived before he went to Mathura. He was born in Mathura, the prison house of Kamsa, but three shifts later, he went back to Mathura. So, Gokul, up to 3 years and 3 months, something like that. I meant to research this before we came. Then they went to some place on the western bank of the river Jamuna, that is in near the present Vrindavan town, and then again they shifted to Nandagram. Nandagram is the ancestral home of Nanda Maharaj and his predecessors. Nanda Maharaj is one of five brothers. The eldest of the five brothers is Upananda. And Nanda is the middle brother of the five. And their father is Parjanya. Parjanya means rain. Nice name for the king of the cowherds. And Parjanya was given that responsibility on behalf of the royal family. To look after that. So there's the kingdom of which Mathura is the capital. And then in the kingdom, there's agricultural land, which is the largest part of the economy. And he was, because at that time, agrarian economy meant Krishi Gorakshavanijam. That's what they did. Vaishya Karma Swabhavijam. Cow protection, producing of products that are tilled from the land. Krishi, agriculture. Goraksha, cow protection. Vanijam, trade and commerce. So, he was in charge. He was the king of the cowherds. And Nandagram, have you been to Vrindavan? No? Oh. Let's go to Vrindavan. There are largely Vrindavan is flat, like much of UP. But there are three hills. Govardhan Hill is the longest and largest. And there are two others, Nandagram and Varsana. Nandagram is a hill. And up on top of the hill was the palace of Nanda Maharaj. It's still there. There was another palace where he lived when they were in Gokul. And it's not a nice place to visit because the people that are in charge there are really aggressive. Especially when they see somebody from the West, you know, American or Indian, they have radar and they pounce on people. Isn't that nice?
But it's a palace. It's also up a little bit raised. Then, so, Nandagram. So they went from Gokul. So this is when he's still less than 3 years, 3 months. He's young. Between 2 and 3. He's doing these things. And, then they shifted. We'll hear at the end of this chapter. And they shifted in one day. They're very portable. They didn't move their home. Their paraphernalia went on the back of bullock carts and they moved in the next day. So, then to Nandagram. And there, Krishna lived until he was 12 years.
And he was invited by Akrura on behalf
death of Kamsa to come to Mathura. And then he left Vrindavan. So this is, he's still very young. And in the early parts of the chapter, there's what happened when the twin Arjun trees, could you fix the sound? It's got a ring back. The twin Arjun trees were pulled over by Krishna with the rope tied on one end and the grinding mortar on the other end, and he pulled over the two trees. And so that happens in chapter 10, and then chapter 11 is Nanda Maharaj hears the crash and he comes running and they're trying to sort out what happened, and the little cowherd boys say, he did it. We saw it with our eyes. So they all say the same thing because he had his friends with him. They're all like, 2 to 3 years old. So who's... the grinding mortar fell sideways. He was crawling. See the marks. He was crawling and he dragged the grinding mortar and uprooted the trees. Big trees. And then not only that, but two celestial beings came out of the trees. Decorated and effulgent, and they spoke to Krishna some words we couldn't understand, and then they just disappeared. Anyway, so they're speculating, how did this happen? And then the next section is the elderly gopis. They would have Krishna dance. You sing and I'll give you half a sweetmeat. And they would clap. And he would dance and smile, and he would, go pick up something. There's a wooden shoes, and he would pick up the wooden shoes and put it on his head and toddle back and give it to them. And so all of those things. Sometimes they would say pick up something that he couldn't pick up. He can pick up Govardhan Hill, but he can't pick up something else, a wooden plank. So he would just point to it, stand there and look at them. And sometimes go like this. Little, 2-year-old, 3-year-old. And so they were just, he was delighting the ladies, the mothers. They were affectionate to him like their own son, even more than their own son. So that was that. And, now let's see, where are we? The fruit vending lady. You know that pastime. So we ended where the fruit vending lady didn't even notice that her basket was filled with jewels. I'll just read it. It's very nice. This is from a little summary. It goes beyond this evening's verse, but this is from Gopal Champu. Gopal Champu is a text in a certain literary form, a Champu form, written by Jiva Goswami, summarizing and paraphrasing and embellishing a little bit, adding some details of this pastime, all of his childhood pastimes. Hear another amusing story. Krishna, who gave bliss to all, heard the attractive words, "Please purchase these fruits." Restless-eyed Krishna, not finding anything to give, in his small hands took a handful of grains, which had fallen on the ground, and quickly went to the fruit seller. But in moving quickly, that's this next verse we're going to read, moving quickly, the grains fell from his small hands without his knowing. He went to exchange his empty hands for the basket of fruit. The fruit seller smiled and was overcome by the sweet expression on his smiling face, making him hold his eager hands out. The woman, from whom he begged fruit, filled his hands with fruits. Enchanted by his sweetness, she did not consider whether her basket was full or empty. When Krishna entered his house, not seeing that her basket made of leaves was full of jewels, and not noticing the load, because jewels are heavier than fruit, she became absorbed in Krishna's beauty. She went home to get more fruit for his family members. When she got home and realized she had jewels in her basket, in separation from the attractive face of Krishna, the fortunate woman began to consider that she had been deprived of the great treasure of his beauty, since in seeing him, she had forgotten the whole world. Knowing that he had brought happiness after great difficulties to the woman, in other words, she was the word that's used is an aborigine. She, you know, she was a forest-dwelling lady and didn't have means. So her life was filled with troubles. So knowing that she had become happy after great difficulties to the woman, he began dancing as if holding great treasure in his hands. He approached his mother and, showing sweet, fickle affections, enthusiastically bound all the fruit in the edge of his mother's cloth. His mother said, "Where did you get these fruits?" The son said, in half words like a child, "An old fortunate woman collected some fruits and, taking the price of in grains, gave me these fruits." His mother said, "O child, do not trust all people like people of this house." The son said, "I do not know about mistrust." Seeing the fruit seller return after some time, Krishna again went to her and then had his mother distribute the fruits to others at every opportunity. His mother blissfully distributed the fruit with her trembling hands, but could never exhaust the fruit. For several days she remained, smiling and astonished. Those who would taste the fruit became surprised by the sweetness and could not forget it. That's where we ended yesterday. So it goes a little bit forward into text 11 from Canto 10, chapter 11. Translation reads, "While Krishna was going to the fruit vendor very hastily, most of the grains he had been holding fell." He has small hands and it just fell through his fingers. Nonetheless, the fruit vendor filled Krishna's hands with fruits and her fruit basket was immediately filled with jewels and gold. And this is Prabhupada's purport. In Bhagavad Gita 9:26, Krishna says, you know the verse, 9:26? Patram pushpam palam toyam yome bhaktya prayachati. You know the verse? Offer me with fruit, with love and devotion, patram pushpam palam toyam. Krishna is so kind that if anyone offers him a leaf, a fruit, a flower, or some water, he will immediately accept it. The only condition is that these things should be offered with bhakti. Yo me bhaktya prayachati. Otherwise, this is Prabhupada's words, if one is puffed up with false prestige thinking, I have so much opulence and I am giving something to Krishna, one's offering will not be accepted by Krishna. The fruit vendor, although a woman belonging to the poor aborigine class, dealt with Krishna with great affection, saying, "Krishna, you have come to take some fruit. You have come to me to take some fruit in exchange for grains. all the grains have fallen, but still, you may take whatever you like. Thus, she filled Krishna's palms with whatever fruits he could carry. In exchange, Krishna filled her whole basket with jewels and gold. Paragraph. From this incident, one should learn that for anything offered to Krishna with love and affection, Krishna can reciprocate many millions of times over, both materially and spiritually. The basic principle involved in an exchange is love. Therefore, Krishna teaches in Bhagavad Gita, the next verse, 927. Yad karoshi yadasnasi yad jahosi dadasi yat yat tapasyasi kaunteya tat karashva madarpanam. O son of Kunti, all that you do, all that you eat, all that you offer and give away, as well as all austerities that you may perform, should be done as an offering unto me. Madarpanam. With love and affection, one should try to give something to Krishna from one's own source of income, then one's life will be successful. Krishna is full in all opulences. He does not need anything from anyone. But if one is prepared to give something to Krishna, that is for one's own benefit. The example given in this connection is that when one's real face is decorated, the reflection of one's face is automatically decorated. Similarly, if we try to serve Krishna with all our opulences, we, as parts and parcels or reflections of Krishna, will become happy in exchange. Krishna is always happy, for he is Atmarama, fully satisfied with his own opulence. So now, I'll read various Acharya's commentaries and a little note. We're depending upon you when we're done to ask questions. The reason for that is it gives time for the people online to send something in, and then we can hear what their questions are. Think of some questions, please. Here's Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. The fruit seller did not even get a full handful of grain. The grains fell on the path as he went outside. When he went to exchange the few grains left in his hand for some fruit, saying, "Bring some fruit." The fruit seller, Pulinda woman, though supposed to sell the fruits, overcome with affection, filled his hands with pilu and other fruit. Because he was greedy for all the fruits, his small hands held them all by the assistance of his Aishvarya Shakti. The Pulinda woman received all types of wealth up to Krishna Prema by his power to bestow all fruits. She didn't just get gold and jewels. Jiva Goswami writes, then what happened? Sukadeva Goswami speaks to Prikshit with eagerness. The vendor filled his two hands, from which the grains had fallen, with fruit, and he filled her fruit basket with jewels. Though his hands were empty because the grains fell out on the path when he came quickly, the vendor, having developed affection for him, filled his hands with fruits, like pilu, as if they were gems. She gave all her fruit. He was able to hold the fruit because, when he developed greed for them, his Shakti, here it says, Vaibhav Shakti, assisted him. Though the grains had fallen from his hands, he gave her all wealth by his natural Shakti, which bestows all fruits. The gems, appeared by themselves, with her senses not functioning because of absorption in the sweetness, ignorant of what had happened, she remained for some time at the entrance to the house. And then, forgetting about loss or gain, went home. Since he is the giver of all fruits, including the highest, later it should be understood that absorbed in him, she attained the highest fruit, prema bhakti. Sanatan Goswami writes, because he went fast, the grains fell from his hands. She put pilu fruit in his hands. The following should be understood. The vendor made her livelihood from selling only fruits. She obtained many valuable gems. In fear, she hid them and returned home, or, thinking the gems were pilu fruits of various colors, satisfied with seeing the Lord, without selling them, she went home. Recognizing them as gems later, she kept them hidden. This incident was not well known in Braja and was not discussed by anyone. People from other places related to Braja became joyful of this exchange, because of this exchange. And one more verse, text 12. This little cameo sections of Krishna's childhood pastime. So this next one, the scene is the boys are playing and Mother Jasoda wants them to come back for lunch. So she's busy cooking. So she sends Rohini, Balaram's mother, to bring them. Once, after the uprooting of the Yamala Arjun trees, Rohini Devi went to call Rama and Krishna, who had both gone to the riverside and were playing with the other boys with deep attention. And Prabhupada's purport, Mother Yashoda was more attached to Krishna and Balaram than Rohini Devi was, although Rohini Devi was the mother of Balaram. Mother Yashoda sent Rohini Devi to call Rama and Krishna from their play, since it was the right time for lunch. Therefore, Rohini Devi went to call them, breaking their engagement in play. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes, to show that Krishna and Balaram were controlled by Yashoda's affection more than even Rohini's, another pastime is presented, which occurred after the breaking of the Arjun trees on the same day. So apparently the Damodar Leela was a morning and this is the afternoon. Later it says it was the next day, but immediately thereafter. Rohini called Krishna and Balaram, who had gone to play on the bank of the Yamuna. Though the verse does not mention Balaram, the commentary does, because in later verses, both boys' names are mentioned. Rohini had been sent to call the boys by Yashoda, who was attached to the boys having lunch. That's mothers. So Jiva Goswami writes, events of a day after the Damodar incident, pastimes are described showing Yashoda's care for her son with great affection, in order to show that she had greater affection and control over Balaram than Rohini had. This description continues until verse 20. Rohini called Krishna, who had broken the Arjuna trees and had gone to the bank of the river. She searched for him with affection. This indicates her anxiety. Krishna was absorbed in playing. She called him by all his names. She was sent by Yashoda, who was attached to preparing meals for Krishna. She called Krishna and also Balaram. That is understood from a later verse. Sanatan Goswami writes, "The activities after being tied up are described with the intention of showing the daily attention Yashoda paid to Krishna with the greatest affection." This is described until verse 20. There are various versions and orders of the verses. It will be explained according to the Gaudiya Sampradaya editions. Now, we discussed this recently, one of the classes, and the explanation goes like this. There are multiple versions of Ramayana. Everyone knows that. Valmiki Ramayana is the gold standard, but there's other, so many other Ramayanas. There's more than one Mahabharata. You might be surprised to hear. There's Vyasadeva's Mahabharata. But when you read carefully in the beginning of Brihat Bhagavatamrita, Jaimini Rishi also has his Mahabharata. And Jaimini Rishi was narrating his Mahabharata to who was the son of Maharaj Parikshit. Maharaj Parikshit was the son of Uttara and Abhimanyu, so the grandson of the Pandavas. And when Maharaj Parikshit turned his kingdom over to his son's name was, starts with a J, Janamejaya. So Janamejaya is hearing about his great-grandparents, the Pandavas, from Jaimini Rishi. And he comments, "Oh, your explanation of Mahabharata is the sweetest I've ever heard. Is there there's a Sanskrit word, kila, like, it's like a companion text to this Mahabharata." And he says, "Sure." Then he starts narrating Brihat Bhagavatamrita, like an addendum. But it's, you know, it's big. So there's multiple, there's at least two Mahabharatas that are known, that I am aware of. And there's more than one Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, I didn't know that until reading our Acharya's commentaries, because from time to time they will say, there's in another version, this word is used instead of that word. So it's not like a whole new composition. It's just some fine detail of something that's a little different in one version than another version, apparently. And the version that our acharyas stick with, that the language that's used, is the Gaudiya Sampradaya editions. And my understanding is that the Gaudiya Sampradaya edition is the one that was used by Sridhar Swami, who Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said he is the great acharya, the standard giving acharya for commenting on Srimad Bhagavatam. So whatever the verses are that he commented upon, that's the Gaudiya Sampradaya edition. And there's some other editions which are known by our acharyas, at least. And they're stating, while this exchange, after the Damodar Lila, it's a little different in different versions, but we're going to stick with the Gaudiya Sampradaya version or edition. Krishna and Balaram had gone to the bank of the Yamuna. Why? He had just broken two trees, which were situated on the bank, or it describes an event right after breaking the trees. He went there afterwards. Rohini called Krishna, whose heart was attracted to playing, thinking he was hungry because of fatigue from playing, or she was worried that he may perform another similar activity, like pulling over the trees. Rohini was sent by Yashoda because Yashoda was busy preparing his meal. Calling Krishna implies she called Balaram also, since out of affection for both, she considered them one. Now that they're commenting that it's only singular in this particular verse 12, and then later verses, Balaram's name also appears, so they weren't alone. Should I read one more? Text 13. Because of being too attached to playing with the other boys, Krishna and Balaram did not return upon being called by Rohini. Therefore, Rohini sent Mother Yashoda to call them back, because Mother Yashoda was more affectionate to Krishna and Balaram. And this is Prabhupada's purport, very short. Yashodam Preshayam Asa. Yashodam Preshayam Asa. These very words show that since Krishna and Balaram did not care to return in response to the orders of Rohini, Rohini thought that if Yashoda called, they would have to return because Yashoda was more affectionate to Krishna and Balaram. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes, when they did not come, Rohini sent Yashoda because she felt that Yashoda had more affection for the boys and could therefore attract them. Jiva Goswami writes, Rohini called them, and then she sent Yashoda, since Yashoda was able to attract them quickly because of her greater affection. Why did she call them? She had affection for her son. She also feared accidents on the bank of the river and wanted to bathe and feed the two boys. And Sanatana Goswami writes, it's a short paragraph and we're done. When Krishna and Balaram did not come to her because they were attached to playing with their friends, she sent Yashoda, since with her great affection she was capable of grabbing them by their hands and bringing them back. Why did she do this? She was affectionate to the two boys. She wanted to bathe and feed them. Rohini sent Yashoda because she knew that Yashoda had more affection for the two boys and therefore could attract them. So it's kind of repeating different acharyas, repeating the same message. So this is chapter 11, and it's the childhood pastimes. So childhood pastimes means primarily parental affection. So going back to chapter 8, 9, 10, now again in 11, we're hearing a lot about the parental affection towards Krishna. So there's two sides to this. There's those who have affection towards Krishna like that, and from Krishna's side, there's a happiness he feels in his relationship with those who have affection for him like that. So he enjoys. They enjoy because he enjoys, not the other way around. But you know, it's love means it's mutual. The lover enjoys the happiness of the beloved. And when there's no false ego, or there's no self-centeredness, but Krishna-centeredness, the happiness is Krishna's happiness. The happiness one derives is Krishna's happiness. And Krishna knows that, who has what kind of love for him, and he stimulates their particular love for him, and their love for him is to see Krishna's happiness. So he's with his little friends, you know, 2-3-year-old boys playing, and when they're playing, they're absorbed in playing. They don't want to, like, you know, they're not thinking, oh, we're hungry, let's stop playing. Don't play indefinitely. It's described that during when Krishna was 3 years and 3 months, he little pastime. It's described in Gopal Champu. He requested his mother, "I want to herd the cows," and she laughed. He said, "You're so small. You know how big the cows are. You can't herd the cows." And he was insisting, and he was insisting. So he said, "I'm going to go ask Nanda Maharaj." So he asked Nanda Maharaj, and his father gave the similar answer, but Krishna was adamant. And, you know, like the lifting of Govardhan Hill or not worshipping Indra, his father just loved Krishna so much. He said, we'll make a deal. You can herd the calves, but you have to come back for lunch. So there was a... It's okay. Somebody's at the door. How do you know? It tells you somebody's at the door? There's a doorbell? Oh. You have a special doorbell system here. Hari Hari. We're talking about Krishna. I hope you want to hear about Krishna. So, it was agreed. They made a deal. He could herd the calves, but he had to come back for lunch. So they had a big festival. It was a big festival that our son is joining the family business at 3 years old. So they were giving gifts. It said, this is Gopal Champu again. It's really nice. Somebody gave Krishna his first flute. Somebody gave Krishna a buffalo horn. Somebody gave Krishna some rope that he could tie around his waist in case he had to tie one of the calves. And they gave different gifts. And Mother Jasoda gave two gifts. She gave a white umbrella and a little pair of those pointy shoes that curl up at the end, like they still have in Rajasthan. Only the ones today have little mylar on them, but the ones that she gave, it was jewels. And Krishna didn't even look at the shoes and said, I cannot accept the shoes unless you make arrangements for a pair of shoes for each one of the calves. And if the umbrella, you have to have an umbrella for each one of the calves, or I won't take the umbrella. And Mother Jasoda said, but Gopal, calves already have shoes. Nature has already given them. And their bodies are such that they're fine just being out in the sun, but you're just a little delicate boy. And he was adamant. He said, I won't accept unless they each have. Doesn't say what happened after that, who won, Mother Jasoda or Krishna. But otherwise he was with his bare feet and going, taking care of the calves. And then when he became 5, that's when he graduated to taking care of cows. And it's described that when he was herding the cows, they weren't really herding the cows. They were just playing. Well, their chapter is describing. Like it comes very soon. It comes in chapter 13. Chapter 13 is the killing of Agasura, but the beginning of the chapter is, this is still with calves now, because Brahma steals the calves and puts them in a cave. So they were going out, and they encountered Agasura. You know that story, right? Big serpent, and they walked into the mouth of the serpent. So after the Agasura was killed, then they stopped and had their lunch. And the Acharyas explain it happened each day. There's prominent ones that are described in Srimad Bhagavatam, but every day, twice daily, a demon would come. It's part of his eightfold pastimes. It's called Ashta Kaliya Leela. During eight different times of the day, different rasas were exchanged between Krishna and his devotees. And the lunch was marked by when the morning demon would come, around 11 o'clock. And when the demon was killed, the boys would go, "Nice going, let's have lunch." And they'd stop and have lunch. Because if they didn't have that interlude, they just would play all day. So as they were playing, the cows or the calves just followed them. They didn't have to herd them. They just, like, you know, watch, you know, people tending groups of cows, and they have to pay attention. But the cows were just following Krishna. And the cowherd boys, and the cowherd boys were just following Krishna. And so he was just, and Krishna and Balaram were just playing like little boys. And then in the afternoon, before it was time to come back, then another demon, and then, okay, now it's time to go back. So that's what our acharyas described. It was a daily function. The prominent ones only are described. So these activities, there's nothing monotonous about Krishna's activities. They're very interesting and filled with variety. And even we know from scripture that Krishna appears in Vrindavan only once in a day of Brahma. You're familiar with that, right? Each day of Brahma, there's 1,000 cycles of the four yugas. And that's a lot of, one cycle of the four yugas is a long time. One cycle is 10 times 432,000, so 4,320,000 years. That's one yuga cycle, 4,320,000 years. And takes 100 of those to make a day of Brahma. Add two zeros to that. And then comes his night, and then there's another day of Brahma. So Krishna performs his pastimes in Vrindavan, his prakat pastimes, his manifest pastimes that everyone can see. Unqualified, qualified, anybody can see. Once in a day of Brahma. And when he performs those pastimes, there's some variation, some variety. It's not always the same and always the same and always the same and always the same. Like, you know, a record. You play a record and it's, or a recording, and it's always the same and always the same. So it's not hackneyed. There's variety. And when you read Brihat Bhagavatamrita, one day you'll have the opportunity to read that. There's a nice description of Krishna's pastimes in other yugas, other of the appearances of Krishna in this world, and some variegatedness of those pastimes go like this. We know that, for example, Keshi, which one is Keshi? The horse? Yeah. And Krishna put his hand inside Keshi's mouth and red hot, and it got bigger and bigger. And it's said because you control a horse by his mouth, very powerful. So Krishna, though, he just made his fist red hot and put his red hot fist that got larger and larger in the horse's mouth. And that way he controlled him. He kills the Keshi demon in our Srimad Bhagavatam. And Brihat Bhagavatamrita says, and sometimes Krishna doesn't kill him, he just tames him. And then he keeps him in a corral, a horse corral. And from time to time, the cowherd boys would go and ride Keshi for fun. So there's variegatedness in Krishna's pastime, just not at all boring. But in each case, it's just a reciprocation with the mood of those who are his devotees. And so this, from end of chapter 8 through chapter 9, chapter 10, beginning of chapter 11, is about parental affection. And emphasis goes to the love of the elders in Braja towards this childhood activities of Krishna when he is a child. But superlative amongst them is Nanda and Yasoda. So much so, I really like this, when the acharyas described, not only because they're eternally Nanda and Yasoda, they're now become Nanda and Yasoda, they're expansions of Krishna's own spiritual form, his Shakti. They're expansions of him. And they have, there's no birth of Krishna because he's the source of everything. But there's the bhava of parental affection. And the parental affection is so strong, they can't see that he's the source of everything. He shows it again and again. I mean, not all the time, but past times where he shows it. And they can't see it, like this pulling over the Arjuna trees, which happened earlier. The boys said, he did it. He pulled these trees over. And they go, no. This little boy. Why, you know, it's not possible. So looking for some other, you know, how did it happen? And why did it happen? Maybe it was a this and that. It's one of the reasons that they chose to leave Gokul. There's these inauspicious things happening again and again. Let's go to the other side of the Jamuna. I like the little section. There's the Brahmanas, because there are also Brahmanas in Braja. They were not so sure, because they're Brahmanas. They were like, you know, analyzing things with their intelligence and saying, well, on the one hand, a little boy, but on the other hand, he's done so many amazing things. And Garga Muni, during the name-giving ceremony, he said, this boy, this son, will be powerful like Narayan. So maybe he did it. They were taking a look at his opulence and considering maybe it's possible. In the morning class, we're going to hear how the gopis start considering like that too. But they can't stay there. The description for the brahmanas or anyone who momentarily looks, the curtain is drawn back and Krishna shows his opulences and then the curtain closes. Wow, what was that? It serves to increase their affection. It doesn't disturb their affection because their affection is so strong, particularly coming from Nanda and Yasoda. It's so strong. All the others are influenced by that affection because they have affection for their king. And he has such affection for Krishna. So they're influencing everybody like that, including the brahmanas. It's in a very interesting place, Vrindavan. And Krishna's enjoying. He enjoys increasing their affection by, from time to time, showing his opulence, and then he withdraws it. Because he's enjoying their affection. And the affection of, in his childhood pastimes, the affection of the elders. Men and ladies, men and ladies, both. Coward men, coward ladies, gopas and gopis. It's very interesting. It says that Balaram, because here there's Balaram and Krishna are off somewhere playing, and they don't want to stop playing. While they're still in, and Gokul, Balaram is acting as a peer, like friend. Although he's referred to, even in those pastimes, as elder brother, he doesn't take the role of elder brother. They're just friends. And then in the later pastimes, in Mathura, and even more so in Dwarka, he takes the role of the elder brother. And you know, in cultured families, the elder brother is a very significant role or function, or respect goes to the elder brother. He's like the father in a family relation, the elder brother. But Balaram wasn't asserting that. He was more just friends at the earlier stage. And then it becomes, in Mathura, a little more. He admonishes Krishna, you have to go, appease the residents of Vrindavan. And he even really gets on his case in Dwarka, then he goes himself from Dwarka. Anyway, there's this unfolding and dynamic flow of pastimes of love in different moods that it's just inspired by Krishna's own potencies, and he's enjoying. He is enjoying their enjoyment, and they're enjoying his enjoyment. It's a very different place. There's obstacles. There's Shankachuda comes along. We read this in the morning session. You know, some bad things happen. And people go, oh no, the trees fell down. Oh, God saved him. The trees didn't fall on him. Here's different. And everything depends upon one's regard for Krishna, how things unfold, and how one is protected when one's feeling oneself dependent upon Krishna for protection. Even his father. Who has this affection for his son like anything, but when the serpent was swallowing Nanda, he called out for Krishna. He didn't call out for the cowherd men. Krishna, save me. And his thought was, Gargamuni said, he'll have potencies and powers like Narayan. So, and with those powers, he will protect the residents of Braja. So the cowherd men, they did what they could, but they couldn't stop the serpent from swallowing Nanda. But Krishna just one touch of his left foot, boop, taken care of. He showed his power. And when everybody went back to Braja and talked about, wow, he did it again. Here's his show of power. And it's just like, how wonderful is Krishna? Who is he? Well, you know, we don't know, but he's certainly not God, because he can't stand being separated from us and we can't stand being separated from him. He starts to cry and he goes and steals. And, you know, he does all these things. How can you be God if you do those things? He's not God. And it's not their reasoning rules it out, it's their love rules it out. And their love gives the reasons. Because atheists, they can also do their reasons and come up with all kinds of things. It's a very special place. A very special quality of love. Okay, so let's see if there's some discussion from our hosts here. Anything at all under the sun?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
You mentioned that Krishna will accept anything that you offer to him out of bhakti. So when I offer to him every day, how do I know? I might have a lot of shortcomings and I might not be in a complete state of bhakti. How do I know if he is accepting what I am offering? Will he send out any signs? If there is, if there are shortcomings so that I can improve and I can at least touch the basic state of bhakti.
Good question. Well, he's not obliged to give us signs. The reciprocation is, on the authority of scripture and our acharyas who explain it. We know things on the authority of Guru Sadhu Shastra. If he wants to show something subjectively, that's completely in his hand. But what he's looking for from you, what you may be looking for from him, is some sign, please. But what he's looking for from you is that you're wherever you are in your spiritual trajectory, you've heard his words, Bhagavad Gita, or his words, and his words are not different than him, and you're in a relationship with him by following his words, because that way you're following him and surrendering to him or submitting to him. And under the guidance of his representatives, the Bhaktivedanta purports to explain what and how. And then there's other details of how and the conditions of cleanliness and this and that. So it's a matter of heart. And how do I know that Krishna is accepting? You know on the authority of scripture that Krishna is accepting. And commonly, I think it's a nectar devotion. Krishna may give some special experience. So then you know he's hearing you and he's reciprocating with you and he's accepting your service. I'll just give a little example. Someone wrote to me about 3 days ago saying a group of us during this pandemic were spending a lot of time and energy and attention on improving the quality of our chanting. And I've been chanting for 13 years and I can honestly say that I'm not absorbed. And Krishna knows whether you're absorbed or not absorbed. He didn't say that, but Krishna knows how much devotion you're investing in offering things to him. Krishna knows. So this particular devotee said, just 2 days ago, I'm inspired to write this letter to you because just 2 days ago, something that had never happened to me before in this 13 years I've been chanting, I was just absorbed in the sound. And those efforts of trying and trying and it wasn't happening, but trying and trying and it wasn't happening, Krishna just picked me up and carried me for all 16 rounds. And it was, time just flew and I was, it was an exhilarating experience. So he was just sharing. So I wrote back, short, saying, Krishna's mercy, and don't be, there's this little short essay by one of my god brothers of, don't seek peak experiences. If Krishna wants, he can pull the curtain back. But don't, that's up to him. We want to feel connected to him. That's what's important. But he doesn't have to show you a sign or anything like that. He may or he may not. Your chanting may one day be sublime and the other, 13 years not so sublime. At least in this particular person's case. Or like we were reading in chapter, where was it? Just after the Govardhan Leela. When the residents of Vrindavan, after the Nanda Maharaj was kidnapped by the residents of Varuna, one of the associates of Varuna, taken to Varuna's abode, Krishna went there. Varuna worshipped Krishna and gave Nanda back. So the residents of Vrindavan, after Nanda came back and told them what happened, they were wondering, who is he? Once again. And then thinking, if he's Narayan, then maybe he'll show us his eternal abode. Because we're samsara people, going up and down with the cycle of birth and death, and here we are, coward people. And if he is Narayan, maybe one day he'll show us the spiritual world. So Krishna, they didn't say it to Krishna, but he understood their heart, and he showed them the spiritual world. It's like the whole description, very elaborate, significant description. And then closed the curtain, and they forgot everything. So the real essence is not that Krishna shows you a sign or something. He may, and sometimes he does. And otherwise, it's just our faith that is the real essence, and I'm not there yet, but the real essence is to try to please Krishna with, in this case, cooking and offering what I cook. And it starts before that. It starts with purchasing. You're not shopping for family. You're shopping for Krishna. It's different consciousness. And when you keep the kitchen clean because it's for Krishna, and you're cooking because it's for Krishna. There's one congregation member somewhere here in the Chicago area that said, I'm struggling with cooking for Krishna. And I was like, what? Because she's, a very experienced devotee. And she said, my whole adult life, I've been cooking for my family. And now I understand I have to cook for Krishna, and I can't make the transition. And so I said, well, you're being very honest. I said, it's easy cooking for my family. I like cooking for my family. And, fortunately they like my cooking, but, cooking for Krishna is a transition. But so that's something that your question is right on, because it's a daily service, and how to do the everyday things that's not mechanical, or the transition from, let's say, being a wife and a mother to being Krishna's devotee, who is my wifely role and my motherly role are just part of this core picture of my service to Krishna. Because someday your daughter's going to be not in the house, and someday, things will change. And then what? What's left? So you want to put Krishna in there at the heart of things now. And if you do that, then that will pass on to your family members. The more that it's there within you, it just naturally gets passed on. So it's a really good question. And so How do you know? You know in the authority of scripture. There may or may not be a sign from Krishna. He's accepting. He knows the mix and the up and the down, sometimes more, sometimes less. He knows all that. He's all-knowing. And you also know sometimes up, sometimes down, just within your question. So you want to move from, you accept this is where I am and move to where you want to go. And you, the most effective way of moving to where you want to go is through the hearing process, through sound, like what we're doing right now, and which you do every day when you chant. And the core sadhana activities will strengthen the do it for Krishna consciousness. Yeah, that's of those two verses. Yad kroshi, yad asnasi, yad jahosi, dadasi, yad. Quote at 927 Bhagavad Gita. The core sadhana practices will strengthen the do it for Krishna dimension in your life. And that takes effort also. And then you can go from being, a religious citizen to a transcendentalist. The transcendentalist is far, consciousness-wise, is far more evolved. And the benefit that you can, just by your living as you live, is giving benefit to others more. Because just being who you are and doing the things that you do, it's giving benefit to others more. It's a more complete standard of service. So even these little things, like, it's a little thing, but it's a very important thing. You making your offer, cooking and thising and thatting and doing it in such a manner that it's for Krishna. You work on it conscientiously. Good question. Anything further? You're good? Huh? Anything? He'll try.
So, Krishna... Krishna was not staying in one place. He was keep moving, he moved from Mathura to Nandagaon, from Nandagaon to Gokula, from Gokula to Vrindavan. So my question is, I didn't understand why he moved from Gokula to Vrindavan. Was there any specific?
It was the parents, the adults, went to Nanda and said, too many disturbances here. Maybe we need to go to a place where it's more auspicious somehow. And so that was the reason. To get away from this jinxed place and something that's better. Just for Krishna's welfare.
But I also heard that, Vrindavan was not there at that time. He created it. Is that true?
No.
No?
No. Vrindavan is eternal, and so the land was there, but that land is, it comes and it goes. The Dham is eternal, but the land was already there. I mean, Nandagram, when, before Krishna was born, there were two very close friends, Vrishabhanu and Nanda. And Vrishabhanu and his wife and Nanda and his wife were very close friends. And they both had the same circumstance. They were without children. So they did yagyas and this and that, but no children. So they decided, let's go from our ancestral home which for Nanda was Nandagaon, and let's go to Gokula. So they both packed up and went to Gokula. And Radha was born there. And Krishna was born, well, with the whole other story. Krishna appeared as the son of Nanda and Yashoda. And where Radha, where Raval is, where Vrishabhanu and Kirtida lived, is not so far, but not, you know, next door neighbors or anything, where Nanda and Yashoda lived. Nanda's palace in Gokul. And then, disturbance, they went back. It's pastimes. And there's some external reason that the elders were considering, but there's an internal reason also. The internal reason in this case is Krishna's childhood pastimes. Okay. Okay. Online.
Sanchari Mataji has three questions. A little off topic, she says. When we share prasadam with someone and then they proceed to eat it as a side with whatever meat
as a side dish
with other meat dishes that they're eating, do they still get full benefit or am I committing any offense?
You're not committing offense. They're getting benefit. You know, full benefit? Well, full benefit is when you're Krishna conscious, taking Krishna prasadam.
If I'm not able to correct them,
give them prasadam.
And the second question is, often it feels like expectations are the foundation of motivation to do or engage in anything. What should be the role of having expectations in spiritual life?
Well, an appropriate expectation in spiritual life is Krishna is kind. And if you place other kinds of expectations instead of that one, then it's fruitive mentality. And with fruitive mentality, that's the mode of passion. And fire, and just as fire burns, passion burns. Kamesha, Krodesha. So, we're conditioned souls, and so we live with expectations. We don't do something unless we have an expectation. We're going to get something, or there's going to be a desirable outcome. But, you know, the measure of what a desirable outcome is, commonly in conditioned life, is in terms of some material yardstick, some material measure. And it takes, you know, it takes purification to go beyond the material expectations to the spiritual expectation. If you live with material expectations, you're a mixed devotee, then you can be certain that Krishna says this in Uddhava Gita. There'll be some unpleasant experiences. Not the spiritual kind, but the material kind. Because of consciousness of material expectation, it burns, just as fire burns. And there's a lesson behind that negative emotion, that burning, is I must be making some mistake somewhere. it's a lesson, and then, you know, we go back and read scripture, and then we get the answer. And but we're not there yet because we're still in the material expectation place. So it's gradual. So we dovetail our expectations with serving Krishna. That's it's commonplace.
Her third question, Sanchari's third question is, in regards to Krishna's flute, I have heard that at the time of death, if we hear the sound of the flute, that means Krishna is calling us home. Is this a sentiment born of speculation or based on spiritual fact?
I never heard that before. But I imagine if you can hear Krishna's flute at any time, you're in good shape.
This is from Vishakha, Radha's sister, Atulya Mataji's daughter.
How old is she?
I asked. I'm not sure, Guru Maharaj.
Huh?
We are waiting to know the age. 5 or 6, I guess.
I think she's younger. 4 or 5.
4 or 5. So her question is, why did Krishna steal butter?
The gopis wanted to give him butter, but he wouldn't take it. He wanted to steal butter. Now, as you know, Vishakha, stealing is bad. But so why did Krishna steal anything? Because he's the source of everything. And he was, it would, or butter or anything else. And even when it was given to him, he wouldn't take it. He wanted to steal. It was for, giving transcendental pleasure to the gopis. Now, there's many ways that he gave transcendental pleasure to the devotees. It wasn't just one thing. But that was one of the things. Because they, the gopis, became irritated. And then, in their irritation, they wanted to reprimand him or scold him. And Krishna liked that. And they had such love for him when they were doing that. It wasn't out of anger. Like we know in this world, when you speak strongly to somebody and you stop this, you know, they didn't have that emotion. They had the emotion of love. And so when they came to report to Mother Jasoda about his stealing, they were laughing and smiling and teasing and, you know, just having fun with Mother Jasoda. With Krishna right in the room where they were saying these things, and Krishna was smiling, or Krishna was crying, or it was just affection. It stimulated a particular kind of parental affection. That's why he stole. But you shouldn't do that.
She's 6 years old.
6, okay.
Yeah. Uttama Bhakta Prabhu's. Oh, she has. Yeah, another question is how to control my mind. How can I control my mind?
Vishakha wants to know.
Yeah.
Better ask your mother. Well, you can start something that Radha asked. Pandava Nirjal Ekadasi. She asked, why do we fast on Ekadasi? Remember that question? I remember the question. And I said, so that you're hungry.
Yes, yes.
But then the purpose of being hungry is not just so that you're hungry, it's to control the senses that then helps control the mind. So you can control your senses by using your senses, starting with the tongue, what you taste, and what you vibrate. You make sounds when you vibrate something. Make sounds that are in relation to Krishna, not in relation to the, you know, selfishness, but in relation to Krishna. So singing, just as we're doing now, hearing and discussing topics about Krishna, that's using the tongue in that way. At least, you know, some part of the day that you do like that in a regulated way. And you take only Krishna prasadam. And so if you control your tongue, you can help control your mind and all the other senses. But it starts with the tongue. That's what Rupa Goswami taught.
This is from Uttama Bhakta Prabhu. Oftentimes, Srila Prabhupada writes, Krishna comes in human form and performs human-like pastimes, but that's his original form and eternal pastimes. Can you kindly elaborate?
Well, it doesn't require much elaboration. Yes, it's his original form, and sometimes he comes this way, sometimes he comes that way, and sometimes he comes in his original form.
This is from Rama Raghava Prabhu. There are several pastimes of Krishna that are debatable yet relished, like stealing butter or kidnapping of Rukmini, display of anger towards Bhishmadev, etc. Why then Rasa Leela not relished likewise? What makes it categorically different from others?
I don't understand the question. Do you understand the question?
So there are other pastimes which are also like debatable why Krishna is doing like that, but still they're relishable, or in general people appreciate and relish that. But Ras Leela pastime, people, it's debatable, but then people don't appreciate as much as they appreciate the stealing of butter.
Well, the different people appreciate in different ways. And some people object to, you know, it's all over the place. You're stereotyping. If I've understood your question correctly, there are some commentators that criticize Krishna in that Krishna incited Arjuna to fight. And that was wrong. You know, there are moralists that say he was wrong. So why even bother with reading Bhagavad Gita? Just go write your own thing and, you know. But they don't do that. So there are persons that appreciate and persons that criticize anything and everything, because they have their own ideology. So I don't agree with the premise. This is relishable and that's not relishable. People will criticize anything. And people will relish anything. And then people will relish in the wrong way. People may relish the Rasa Leela in the wrong way. Let's go imitate. So, you know, the modes of nature are very complicated, and people that are involved in the modes of nature can take anything and twist it out of beyond recognition. So, and that, so sure, I agree with the premise of the question.
This is from Radha Vallabha Prabhu. Fruit vendor pastime is very instructive in terms of sharing one's opulence to Lord with love. So when one shares their opulence lovingly, is there a quality and quantity element involved? Since Srila Prabhupada does state of using at least 50% of one's wealth for Krishna conscious services.
Well, aside from the 50% principle, yes, there is qualitative and quantitative. Here's a standard, really easy to understand one. Sometimes people that are poor, they're very generous. And sometimes people that are very wealthy are very stingy. Proportionate to what their capacity is, the wealthy person may be charitable in a very small way. Now, certainly that's not always the case. But persons that are fond of their wealth, they like to keep it. Many people like to keep it. And people that are, my experience is, people that are not so wealthy, they understand that the importance of wealth, and they use it in a generous way. I've noticed that. So, I don't know if that's responding properly to his question.
Should I go to the next question?
Huh? Should I go to the next
question? Yes, please. So, Radhavalla Prabhu's second question is, for practicing sadhakas, following carefully the instruction of devotees, when some instruction resonate actively in their heart, is that equivalent to opening of the curtain by the Lordship?
No. That's the phrase that I've been using in relation to Krishna's pastimes, where opening the curtain, at least the way that I've been using it, indicates Krishna shows his divinity to the residents of Vrindavan, and then he withdraws that, so it just becomes the predominance of the loving mood. And the other is this example that he's giving. Sounds more like, you know, the more of the mode of goodness, and then we can realize or resonate with something that's a transcendental instruction because of being more in the mode of goodness. It touches our heart. It's something it resonates with us. So that's different.
This is Uttama Bhakta Prabhu's question. Lord Balaram enhances pastimes of Krishna in a very intimate way.
Mm.
Is Lord Balaram's being with gopis on the occasion of Holi part of that, or he can also serve in other functions like extension of Krishna's enjoying capacity?
He serves in all features of rasa and functions of Krishna. And that's the whole topic. So the answer is yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. My question is, are we not being selfish when I expect that if I do bhakti, I'm going to be sent back to Godhead? Why should I expect that as my result and just be happy with doing bhakti and devotion?
Nice question. The highest position is not with that expectation. However, given our position, it's a good expectation. Lord Chaitanya teaches, my dear Lord, in his Shikshastaka, my dear Lord Krishna, you can do with me whatever you like. It's like Prahlad says, you can do with me whatever you like. You can neglect me. You can embrace me. You can trample me under your feet. You can do with me whatever you like. There's only one request. Please engage me in your service, birth after birth. Not asking for liberation. I'm not asking for a special treatment. All I want is to be engaged in your service, birth after birth. That's up there, and we're down here. So it's good when you're down here to wish to be with Krishna, to be able to handle the the dualities of this world and rise above it and stay connected with Krishna and just be eternally with Krishna. That's good. And when you reach the stage that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was describing, or Prahlad Maharaj describes in his prayers, saying, no expectation. Just please keep me engaged in service. So, which is the higher position? So we're in this mixed position. And that's, you know, it's an honest statement of where we are. We're not at that most elevated position yet. So now what do? It's acceptance and progress. You accept this is where I am. I want to aspire for that selfless service. Let me make a step in that direction. A doable one, sustainable one. That's not, you know, jumping really high and then crashing down again. Just move in steps towards that goal. Does that answer your question? Okay. Fantastic.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Prabhu was sharing from his Bhakti Shastri, one of the lessons. So he was talking about the 64 offenses in front of deities.
Yeah.
And one of them was not to dress in dark colored clothing in front of deities.
She is a Bhakti Shastri teacher. You want to answer that one?
So my question is, I mean, growing up in Brahmana families, we were always taught to dress neat and nice. And I'm a little confused. Is it because you see it as an offense? I don't know how to frame it. But I don't know. I mean, so please explain, Mataji, how is that an offense?
Does that come up in your nectar devotion class? And how do you answer it?
The way I shared was that specifically what was told was not bright red and bright blue. So the way I heard and I shared was, it's not, we don't become the center of attraction in a temple where Krishna is the Lord and we dress up like so, like gorgeously and bright colors. It's all worship goes to Krishna and it's not about us. So I don't know if this is that's what I've heard before. So.
Okay.
So my question is, I mean, if you're, is it?
What about on your wedding?
Yeah. So it is always you dress up in bright silk saris. So is that an offense because
you're
sense gratifying yourself dressing up?
Well, go back to her question. It's another way of asking her question. And when people do like that, it's generally a mix. You know, just being honest, it's something and it's something. It's, you know, coming before Krishna, it's in nice attire, and there's the mix of, look at me. It's, you know, or here's my opulence and I'm displaying my opulence. So it's commonly, it would be something of a mix. Now what do? Move towards pleasing Krishna. Now, there's different ways of moving. You can just trash it. That's false renunciation, according to Rupa Goswami. And then the yatharham upayunjitaha is according to suitability. So according to suitability is kind of like a very subjective term. What's suitable for one may not be suitable for another. But if you want to move towards, let me be pleasing to Krishna. if I'm going to sing nicely, if I'm going to dress nicely, if I'm going to cook nicely, if I'm going to anything nicely, I want it to be for the pleasure of Krishna. The point of application may be different, but the principle is the same. It's a real easy one. Young people, commonly, they like kirtan. And what they like about kirtan is not the holy name. They like the musicality, and they like the social interaction, and they like, you know, music is like a universal language for people, and young people included. And to move from they like to do it for Krishna, that's big. So it's not stop, don't stop, you know, just stop doing kirtan because you like it too much. Just learn to move towards the pleasure of Krishna. And that may take a while and take a conscious effort. So in the meanwhile, you don't stop kirtan or you don't stop dressing nicely. Move to the position that you do that for Krishna. And then there's some other people. There's some other people I know. They're not into it. They have financial means, but they're not into. And so they dress quite, you know, not like to show off their renunciation. They're just not into it. So, you know, there's not something wrong with those people. There's not something wrong with the other people. They have a disposition like this. They have a disposition like that. And both should be moving towards whatever it is that I do, let me do that for the pleasure of Krishna. That's bhakti. That's the bhakti principle, whether it's on this side or that side. Here's something that it's not specifically a nectar devotion instruction, but he says, a candidate, a qualification for bhakti is one who is neither too detached or too attached. The too attached is material consciousness. The too detached is impersonal. So a good candidate is one who is neither too attached nor too detached. Well, that's good. So I'm eligible. Now, what's important is what's grown in that gestation chamber, that incubation chamber, is bhakti. That's what we want. Because that's a candidate for bhakti. So, someone is raised like this, and somebody is raised like that. And their mood is like this, their mood is like that. Okay. Not too much and not too much. Now, grow the bhakti. And grow the bhakti by the same as the other question, by the principle of hearing, by sound, from the right source. And hearing as much as we can, and then like your question, something resonates. So, good. No, it was one of the online questions. Something resonates. So then you do that, because it resonates. And then you get closer to Krishna. Because you're inspired because it resonates and you're making your Krishna connection channel stronger. All right?
Thank you, Maharaj.
More? See, this is what happens when you ask questions. We get more questions.
This is from Sasireka Mataji. Even some kids born in Brahmana family and have had good association, then why do they not follow the path of bhakti? Is their prarabdha karma is more prominent than the environment given? Then what is the role of environment in inculcating devotion?
I'm not sure what, you know, I'm pretty sure what the question is, but the condition, what about this and what about that, I'm not so clear. In general, and then in specific, in general, everything that's good in the age of Kali becomes diminished. Praye nal payushak shabya kalavasmin yugage in amanda samanda mateo manda bhagya yupadruta. Everything becomes diminished. Everything good gets diminished. So, to be born in a Brahmin family is a great opportunity. And what that Brahmin family birth represents as the age of Kali diminishes for a variety of reasons without going into it too much. The essence of that merit is, a family is not just your genes, but the family atmosphere that's sattvic and inspires specifically, hearing the message of scripture from qualified sources, because not just the family, but those who the family interacts with and the activities that the family does are more in the direction of sattvic propensities. And in the age of Kali, everything becomes diminished. And so what's most important is not one's birth. What's most important is, the awakening of bhakti. Because a brahmana may not be a devotee, may not be bhakta. Could there be different types of brahmanas? And there's this nice essay. It's like a little book by Bhaktisiddhanta that in Vedic culture, the Brahmana group is extremely appreciated. And then the second part is amongst the exalted Brahmana becomes a Vaishnav. So the Vaishnav is in that very, very special blessed position. And if one becomes, when has the association of a Vaishnav, it's more important than the modern Brahmana, because the Brahmana, everything becomes diminished, and bhakti may not be there at the heart. One may be very, very qualified in learning capacity and reciting and memorization and there are verses in the Bhagavatam that say, even if a brahmana is expert in all of the 12 hermeneutical qualifications, but has not awakened their bhakti, they're less, their association is less important than one who is not elevated by birth, but has become a devotee. Because the bhakti is the essence, not the birth and the material assets, or the other assets, the assets that come with piety. Janma, Aishwarya, Shruta, and Shri. According to Queen Kunti, those benefits that come from, elevated activities in life, they can be a detriment to, according to her prayers, from sincerely taking shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord. So pride can overwhelm bhakti. And so what's the antidote? It's the antidote is bhakti association regardless of birth. And if fire is applied to dry wood, it could ignite more quickly than fire applied to wet wood. So by birth, a Brahmana has a great advantage. By birth, one who is not born in a lower mode of nature family has less facility. But the most important thing is you can make dry wood, wet wood into dry wood. But if the person who is born in a Brahmin family doesn't have the spiritual, the bhakti qualification, but is proud of their heritage or their birth, etc., and the endowments that go along with it, it's an impediment for bhakti. It can be. So the essence is awakening of bhakti. However, it can happen. When Prabhupada tried to start, expand his Bhaktisiddhanta's teachings in India, it didn't happen right away. In part, because that wasn't his instruction. When he came back to India with American, a person can watch the Hare Krishna movie, and when the American, the Western European American devotees went back to India, it was an explosion. People of India that were going towards the American way or the European American way saw these European Americans taking shelter of that which they were giving up, and they left it for that, you know, the heritage and the culture that many were leaving behind. So bhakti is at the essence, is the point here.
This is from Sangeeta Kapoor Mataji. I always thought that demons who were killed by Krishna all attained liberation being killed by the Lord. Also, when Prahlad Maharaj was asked by Narsingadev to ask for any benediction, he asked for forgiveness and liberation for his father. Then why was he born again as Ravana?
He was forgiven for all of his sins. His slate was wiped clean. There's a very long purport in Chaitanya Charitamrita that explains, but I'll try to summarize it. By being killed by Hiranyakashipu, by Lord Nrisimhadev, Hiranyakashipu, all of his sins were eradicated, but his bhakti hadn't been awakened. So he achieved a position where he was freed from sin, but not ready to move on to his spiritual position. And those who are killed by Krishna, like on the Kurukshetra battlefield, they were just killed in Krishna's presence. They achieved liberation. We had this discussion, one of our morning or evening classes on this topic. Can you send her that verse from Chaitanya Charitamrita that speaks about the three, only Shishupal achieved liberation, and the others did not because, you know, which verse I'm referring to? Chaitanya Charitamrita.
This is from Chandana Mataji from Naperville. We know that Mayavadis aspire to merge into the Brahman for liberation, but Jivas, being individual parts or sparks of the whole, do some actually merge into Brahman and lose their individuality, or is it just a mistaken conception or mistaken understanding of liberation?
It's possible. What merging into Brahman means, individuality is suspended, but the soul still exists along, packed in with so many other souls. Prabhupada gives this example. You know, modern science is debating, is light, a wave, or a particle, right? That's like a debate. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and all of that. But Prabhupada would speak with the language that the sunshine is tiny particles of light, and they're packed up together to make sunlight. Similarly, the Brahmajyoti is compared like that. It's unlimited numbers of living entities packed in together where their individuality is suspended. It's not gone, but they're not exhibiting their individuality. So that's what Sayuja Mukti means. Hari Dayananda Maharaj gives this example. It's really funny. It's a sports example. Supposing one football team is at the, you know, they're at the 1 yard line and they want to get the ball across the goal line. So they give it to their fullback and they run into all these players and you can't, they're all packed up together and then they wait till they unpile and see if he made it across the goal line. American football example. So the Brahmajyoti is like that, just packing in with, so with teeming with so many other little particles of light. It's, you know, because the living entity is like Krishna. So it's, that's what the Brahman effulgence is. It's little particles of Brahman teeming about. And so one may enter into that, but you can't stay there because there's no shelter there. And the desire for activity awakens and one comes again. Aruya Krishna Parampadam Tada. One again falls. So that's what, does that answer that question? Okay. I think we take one more and then we're going to end. However many, there's no more?
Two more.
Uh-oh. Just do one. Just do one because after one comes three more.
This is from Tejas Prabhu from Naperville. Why would someone who join ISKCON and follow the principles when they live in Dwaraka but commit sins, do they still reach Vaikuntha Dham? I think this is also part of NOD. There was a section said that when one lives 1 year or 6 months or even a fortnight in Dwaraka, they attain Vaikuntha. So the question is, after committing sins?
Well, if you commit sins living in the holy dham, you'll take another birth. You know, the potency in these examples of nectar devotion, this is my understanding. It's not exaggeration. There is potency in these things. Like, you know, here's one. It's in nectar devotion. One who sees that the deity of Lord Jagannath passing in procession attains a forearm form. Now I see people at Rath Yatra and they're seeing Lord Jagannath and they're eating something and drinking something and smoking something and I don't see any forearm forms. That is to say that the potency is there. But if one engages in sinful activity, then it has a countering effect to the fullness of that potency. So if one commits sin in the holy dham, then you're responsible for that. What Prabhupada said in Vrindavan, you may take birth as an animal in Vrindavan, and then the animals don't commit sin, so from that animal birth, then they go back to Godhead. Okay? Krishna, Krishna. Prabhupada ki jai.